this chapter by Henderson in the Jung book, and I don't know that the pagination on the different versions of the book would line up, so I'm not going to read the page number. There's a point where he says the following: this crucial link between archaic or primitive myths and symbols produced by the unconscious is of immense practical importance to the analyst. It enables him to identify and to interpret these symbols in a context that gives them historical perspective as well as psychological meaning. Now, the thing I've been emphasizing in this class is almost the reverse of that, which is that a way of understanding religious symbolism is to look at it as the collective activity of the minds that preceded us. Now, Jung talks about the fact that there are elements of the more archaic mind within us right now. But the way I'm flipping this in this class, which is the point of importance, is that the way we understand what these symbols mean is because we have within ourselves the same capacity as primitives had or other peoples had, not necessarily primitive, to produce those symbols. If we didn't have within ourselves the same mechanism, as it were, of understanding that they had to produce the symbols, we wouldn't be able to understand them. So we couldn't have a class like this in the study of religion, because it'd be like looking at symbols, like we'd taken a rocket ship to another planet, and there were symbols that we found, you know, chiseled into a rock someplace on Mars, but what would it mean? We couldn't possibly understand what it would mean, because there's nothing Martian about us, so we don't share that experience. Okay, so you understand that point. And I emphasize this because this question, why are we studying this material that's coming out of analytic psychology? It's because the analytic psychologists worked through the material and looked at it and gave it meaning, a new kind of meaning, which nobody else had done. We're looking at it from a different point of view, but the reason we can understand the meaning of those symbols is the same reason as the analytic psychologist could understand the dream symbols. Okay, maybe this is an example of the syllogism and grasp type of thinking, so that it's hard to grasp. It's not fully rational, but we have an associationist mind, as did other peoples. And if we can engage with the symbols produced in our own mind or the symbols left by other societies, we can only do that successfully if we do it with that part of our mind, which is a stretch for most of us, and it's especially a stretch in the university situation, because everything about university life and the intellectual life of universities is rational in character. It's not metaphoric, it's not metaphysical, it's not associationist, it's not schizophrenic, it's not about dream time, right? So it presents challenges. So the question you asked was, we're looking at this scene where Dorothy and her companions, three other aspects of them herself, are walking down the yellow brick road. And at the foot of the road, or what they've walked away from, are the poppies. And off in the distance is the city of Oz, which is the goal. So let me answer your question about what's going on here with a couple of observations. Okay, one observation is they're arm in arm. Do you see that? They're linked together. Symbolically, this means that what's happened is Dorothy has completely integrated what those three other characters represent. That's one thing. As Alex has pointed out, the Wicked Witch sends the poppies to make them unconscious, to make all of them unconscious, right? And if I recall correctly, the scene, what we have is she grows the poppies and they cover the road. It's not even that they're on the side of the road and that they're induced to go pick poppies, but my recollection is that they cover the road. The point is they can't get to the last stage of going to Oz, to the symbol of the self, which is what Oz is, until they get past what the poppies represent.
So on a most mundane level, the poppies represent alcohol, drugs. On another sense, they represent what these things represent, which is ecstatic states. Okay, so the story says that unless you get past spiritual unconsciousness, which poppies represent, or the ecstasy of drugs, you can't get to the last stage. You get stuck, and you can't go any farther. There's abundant history in the 20th century and 21st century, for the truth of that matter. Okay, so what we're seeing in this scene is that the Dorothy character, who is now complete because she has Toto in the basket, who she's carrying, who is instinct, and the companions who've helped her out in this process, who are aspects of herself, they're all united together as they're going down the road. All of this is required to get to Oz, to the goal, which is the symbol of the self in Jungian sense, or God. Okay, so is this making a little bit more sense to you?
Yes.
This thing about having to go through the poppies, if you look at every spiritual tradition, you find that on the one hand, ecstasy, not necessarily drug-induced, I'm not talking about that, but ecstasy, ecstatic state, ecstasis, I'm mispronouncing it, it's a Greek word which means out of the body. It means to get beyond the mundane, to have a transcendental experience that lifts you out of yourself. That's one of the attractions of mysticism and the spiritual path. But this story is saying that if you get stuck in ecstasy, and I don't mean the drug, although you could say the drug, if you get stuck with the ecstatic state, you don't get beyond and you don't go the next step. I think if you looked at Sufi mysticism in particular, you would probably find a lot of literature about this. Ramakrishna, who we've studied in this class, draws the distinction between, one of the ways he draws a distinction about Bhakti yoga and what's called Jnana yoga, which is a yoga of knowledge. He says the thing about, actually, he draws the distinction between Bhakti yoga and a state of total unity with God, in which this whole sense of separation is eradicated. You become one with God. So we saw him in these states of samadhi where he almost appeared unconscious. In those states, one experiences nothing in particular or everything in general. I mean, I don't exactly know how to describe this because I've never been there, but as I understand it, this is a state of such complete union that the sense of I as separate from it is gone. And what remains is the totality of everything, or the totality of nothing, which might be the same thing. Ramakrishna said, I don't want to stay in that state. He said, I'd rather be in the state of bhakti, because I would rather taste sugar than be sugar. I'd rather taste sugar than be sugar. To be in a state of complete union is to be sugar. But for you to be separate from God, even if only a little bit separate, then you have that relationship. And in relationship, there's joy, there's pleasure, there's ecstasy. There's a certain message probably buried in there about the meaning of life and being incarnated in a body and things like that. But that would be a little bit of an aside for us to get to. But I think that that's starting to get to where your question is, maybe on the very deepest level, okay? Now, in regards to this image that we're looking at, and the reason that I wanted to start it here, and then we'll actually start playing the movie, was I wanted to point something out to you about the city of Oz. Look at the structure of the city. Remember the images that I was drawing for you about the cube and the hemisphere? Okay. So even here in this 1930s modernistic vision, and remember that the 1930s that the New York World Fair was taking place around this time. This is the kind of architectural vision that was emerging at this time. But the thing that's very interesting is basically you have the hemispheric shape, not on a cube, but on a cylinder. But there is something similar about the image. And this is associated with the image of the self, the goal. Oz is the goal of the story. The city of Oz is the goal of the story. But Oz represents something, and in spiritual terms, what it represents is the goal of religious life. It's the completion of the spiritual quest. Of course, what we know, to speak in advance of where we're going here, what we know is once she gets there, once Dorothy gets there, she discovers that that's not the end of the story. She becomes fully empowered, and she discovers she really has capacity to do what she always had the ability to do but didn't know she had the ability to do, or until she was united with these other functions and saw through the falseness of Oz, the Wizard of Oz, the projections into Oz. So she saw through that, she couldn't go home. There's no place like home. She clicks her heels. Glinda tells her about this. She clicks her heels, she goes home. She could have always done this, theoretically, but of course she had to go through the journey to do this. The hero's journey requires that they find the treasure, and then they come back to the world and share with the world what that treasure really is. So Dorothy comes back to the world, and what is it that she shares with everybody in the movie? Oh, Auntie Em, there's no place like home. There's no place like home. But what does home really mean? Home doesn't really mean a shack in Kansas, right? Home means something else. It means something much deeper, which is what Dorothy has discovered in this whole story. Okay? So let's watch.